When it comes to naming our children, parents do the best they can. They looked high and low and near and far to find just the right name that someone will bear for a lifetime. It's no easy task to pick a name, so it should not surprise us that people often turn to the Scriptures to find names for their children. James, John, Andrew, Peter, Mary, Martha. Those are the kinds of names that we still have scattered all across this congregation today. One name, however, from the Bible that you hardly ever, if ever, hear people named is that of Judas, one of the 12 disciples of Jesus. It was against the law in Germany to name your child Judas. It just doesn't make good sense in America to do that. Nevertheless, Judas Iscariot is one of the 12 disciples whom Jesus appoints as an apostle. He's the treasurer of the group. He's a friend of Jesus. He's in the close knit of those who have the potential to bring the kingdom of God on earth. And yet, he betrays his closest friend with a kiss. And those words ring to us again and again as Jesus says to Judas, on the occasion of his arrest, would you betray the Son of Man with a kiss? Would you betray the Son of Man with a kiss? I want to talk about this valley of betrayal today. And I would like to track the life of Judas to see if we can learn some things to do and not do as we journey this journey together. What made Judas betray his Lord? I suppose nobody really knows the answer to that question. As for John the Apostle, who wrote the Gospel of John, the answer was simple. Greed made him do it, said John. For John, Judas was a thief, a money grabber, a backstabber. He knew how to take the cash and let the credit go. One day, Martha anoints Jesus' feet with expensive perfume, and Judas protests. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money of it taken and given to the poor? It was worth a whole year's wages, says Judas. But John will have nothing to do with that story. He says almost in parenthesis, as you can read in the Gospel of John, why he didn't say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As a keeper of the money bag, he dug in the till every time he needed a little extra cash along the way. Never be too quick to dismiss the deadly sin of greed, which lurks in the shadows of all of us. Greed causes us to betray others, and more than that, to betray ourselves. It does great harm. When Enron executives sat quietly in their offices and plundered the life of millions of people, greed was in play. When honest salespeople pad their expenses under the excuse that, well, everybody does it anyway, I might as well do it as well, greed is in operation. When people lie on their year-end reports, slip a few dollars from the cash register into their pockets, cheat on their income taxes, greed is the motive deep in life. Before long, we become what we do not perceive ourselves to be. A thief, a robber, a rogue, a person who lives a compartmentalized life. I'm amazed how people can sit in church on Sunday morning and look righteous and pious and at the same time carry on a whole lifestyle that is in the shadows from time to time. Greed is never far away from any one of us. Some people said he did it for the money. 30 pieces of silver in our day is worth about $10,000. Not a bad day's work if you're after money, so Judas betrays his Lord. Other people, however, think that money has nothing to do with it whatsoever. That Judas was a zealot, that he was a violent nationalist, that he wanted Rome overthrown and power restored to his own people. He attached himself to Jesus because Jesus was an obvious leader. He could get things done. He could make dreams come true. And so it is that he believes that if he follows Jesus, Jesus will overthrow the Roman government. But you know how Jesus is. He operates on his own timetable. God doesn't ask us what time to do things. He just does it when he chooses to do things in his own schedule, in his own way. And Jesus is slow to act. So some people think Judas decides to force the hand of Jesus. Surely when his life is on the line, surely he'll stand up in self-defense. Surely he'll rouse the people. Surely he will cause a riot that will lead to a change in government. And so Judas betrays Jesus in a twisted effort to bring about change, which ought to be a lesson for all of us along the way, especially those of us who are compelled to take matters in our own hands. It was Shakespeare who said, "Trying to better, we oft mar what is well." I suspect that is true. Trying to better, we oft mar what is well. At best, we see in part and know in part and stumble around most of the time in the dark. And to assume that we know how to run the world instead of God is a rather narcissistic idea of life. In the spring of 2006, the National Geographic Society did a documentary on the Gospel of Judas, a work dating back to the second century. They showed it, I found interesting, on Easter holiday weekend, a way to make a lot more than 30 pieces of silver off an ancient piece of literature. And so it got the world in a buzz and talked for a little while. In the Gospel of Judas, Judas is the hero. He and Jesus are best friends. They plan this plot together for Judas to hand Jesus over to the Pharisees and the Romans so that the Son of Man can fulfill his mission on earth and earn his right to heaven. It's a twisted piece of Gnostic heresy, which has threatened the church since the second century or so, and manages to show up from generation to generation. In this version, Judas is the enlightened one, and the rest of the disciples are in the dark. He and Jesus are right together and have it all figured out. The rest of the disciples don't have it figured out at all. Of course, nowhere in the Bible can you substantiate that notion? And the words of Jesus keep ringing in our ears. Are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? Are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? A sign of affection, a word of friendship, an act of love. Are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? Whatever his reasons, he creates a problem. He creates a problem for the world, but he also creates a problem for himself. I've tried to trace some of the statements of Judas, and one of them I've stated for you in the sermon notes today is from Matthew 27, verses 3 and 4. You may want to follow them there under the problem. And when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 silver coins to the chief priests and the elders. And he said, "I have sinned, for I have betrayed innocent blood." In one searing moment, Judas saw how tragically far wrong his carefully thought out plan had gone. He betrays his Lord. Now, betrayal is no small matter, my friend. To break the trust of a friend is serious business. When married couples promise to love, honor, and cherish each other for a lifetime, and then break that agreement in some selfish fling of emotion, souls are wounded and people are hurt. When a friend knowingly breaks a confidence, a betrayal is taking place. And souls are wounded, and people are hurt. When a boss or organization pretends to be honest and fair while manipulating employees to exploit their talents, souls are wounded, and people are hurt. When a colleague pledges their political support and then works against you, behind your back. Souls are wounded. And people are hurt. To break a trust is serious business. To betray another is a serious breach of relationships. Let's not make the matter light. It was Muhammad who said, there are three signs of a hypocrite. When he speaks, he lies. When he makes a promise, he breaks it. And when he is trusted, he betrays the trust. Which, of course, brings us to a question. Can betrayal be overcome? Can trust be restored? If relationships are broken by betrayal, then is there any way to recover it? And my answer to that is yes, if. Both of those words are important. Yes, if. Yes, if the facts are faced. You got to give Judas a little credit here, you know. He realizes what has happened. Whether he intended to do it or not, nobody knows for sure, but at least the guilt sets in on him. And he begins to realize what has taken place. And so he goes to the chief priests and elders and say, I have sinned. I have betrayed innocent blood. He's not out to blame somebody else, to put the problem someplace else. He's willing to take responsibility for his own actions. Are you? Are you? I'm amazed at how good we are at rationalizations. But Judas doesn't rationalize. I have sinned. I have betrayed innocent blood. Can betrayals be overcome? Yes, if. Yes, if the betrayed person is encountered. And herein lies a problem for Judas. He goes to the chief priests and the Pharisees and says, I have sinned. I have betrayed innocent blood. The problem is they're in on the plot from the beginning. The problem is they're part of the deal. The problem is he hasn't sinned against them. He sinned against his Lord. And sooner or later, he's got to deal with God. Sooner or later, he's got to come face to face with the one that he has betrayed. Sooner or later, he has to get honest with the one who's hurt. That's why I love that prayer of Psalm 51. Everybody ought to have it memorized. If you sin as much as I do, you need it all the time. Psalm 51. The prayer of King David. Do you remember what he said? For I know my transgressions. My sin is ever before me. Against you and you only have I sinned and done that which is evil in your sight. Sooner or later, you got to come face to face with the person you've hurt. You got to deal direct. And yes, betrayal can be overcome if you go that route. If you don't try to skirt the issue. It's no time for excuses. It's no time for dodging the bullet. It's time for coming. I know my transgression. My sin is ever before me. Can betrayals be overcome? Yes, if. Yes, if you take the time to build trust back again. You see, trust is a very fragile thing. There's nothing automatic about trust. I've seen it happen hundreds of times. A spouse betrays another. The guilt and the pain and the brokenness of it wants relief. So I confess my sins and I want it to all be better now. All be taken care of. Let's just forget it and get on with life. Nice thinking. Doesn't work. You see, trust doesn't happen like that. It takes time for trust to be built. It's one step forward and a couple steps backward, and it's a couple steps forward, and you try again on that road of trust. It's a slow, tedious process. And the problem is that Judas cuts it short. He never gives himself a chance to become trustworthy. He lets his despair end his life. And so he throws the money back in the temple and he goes out and hangs himself. What good has that done? What help has that been? None whatsoever. There's no relief in that. He went out and hanged himself. 735,000 Americans tried to commit suicide last year. About 32,000 of them succeeded. Suicide is the eighth leading cause of death in America today. Among people aged 15 to 24, it's the number third leading cause of death in America today. We have a problem, my friends. Some people call it a death culture. The rise of euthanasia, the whole sense of terrorists, suicide bombers, the whole sense of violence in movies and video games, and the tragic reality that teenagers are walking into schools and opening fire on their classmates and then turning on themselves is a tragic story in the history of America. We used to be shocked by it. But we're not shocked anymore. And I'm saying to you today, there's some things we ought not to get used to, ever. Not ever, ever. And suicide is one of them. I want to say it kindly, but I want to say it firmly. You have no right to take your life. Your life is not yours for the taking. Your life is not yours for the choosing. Your life is a trust from God. And by the way, you're not God. Suicide is an irreversible act of selfishness that causes great pain and brokenness to those who love us and the people of the world. Suicide is a long-term solution to a short-term problem. You have no right to take your life. You have no right to do that. Because your life is a trust from the Lord. So what happens to Judas? Nobody knows. But God. Nobody knows. Of this I'm certain, that the Roman Catholics were wrong in declaring suicide an unpardonable sin until 1983 and excluding such persons from a Catholic burial. I don't think you can classify suicide as an unpardonable sin. Suicide is often not a death wish, but a desperate search for relief, and often the final stages of mental illness, particularly depression and bipolar sickness. All of us are at the mercy of God. And the grace of God is sufficient for our every need. All of us rest in the mercy of God. How is it the psalmist put it? God is merciful and slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. God is different than you and I. And God holds our lives in His hand. There's an old fable about Judas. That after his death, he wandered the universe looking for somewhere to rest his weary soul. Hell wouldn't take him. The earth wouldn't have him. He could find no resting place in all of creation. But at last, in a nameless region of dark and cold, the soul of Judas saw a lighted hall. He made his way to it. Heard laughter and music on the other side. He walked in. To his ultimate surprise, there was a table there. A table for 13 people. 12 were already seated. The hosts of the place got up and went over and greeted him with a kiss. And said to him, "We've been waiting a long, long time for you to come. We've been waiting a long, long time for you to come." Some of us walk through the valleys of the shadows of death. Some of us know the pain of depression and sorrow. Some of us have had to pick up our lives after a loved one has taken their lives. I pray that somewhere down in the shadows of betrayal and grief, that you will hear the Lord saying to you, "We've been waiting a long time for you to come home. We've been waiting a long time for you to come." May you find peace in the valley. The peace of God that passes all understanding. May it come to your valley, and may God be present with you. That is my prayer.